Now, I want to speak to Colin Breen. We featured Colin a few times on this programme and have another chance to talk to him today. A force like no other. Colin, good morning.
Good morning, Frank.
Colin, you wrote the book. You're in many ways tribute to the RUC. You're an RUC member yourself. You're now a writer. You brought us A Force Like No Other. This is a second book that you've brought out. Tell me about it.
It's actually called A Force Like No Other, the Next Shift. And it's really a continuation, although it differs. And I don't just mean in terms of the actual stories, but even in the nature, because I was conscious of not trying to write the same book twice. But really, it's a recollection of anecdotal stories from colleagues and obviously some of my own stories, which I was asked to do following the first book being well received. And so it was done and just came out last month.
Do you set out to pay tribute? Do you set out to remind us of the dilemmas the police face? Do you set out to conjure up debate or discussion? What's your motivation in writing, Colin?
My motivation, first of all, was I thought I was going to write a funny book of all the sort of crazy, stupid, bizarre things that happen across the world to police officers when they're out on duty. And the old black humour that allows them to survive the world over. They can find things funny that normal people, as we call them, would probably be horrified at. But it was their defence mechanism to cope with what they were being faced with. So I thought I was going to write a funny book, but as time went on and I spoke to colleagues and they started to tell me stories that they'd never told their families, and I realised then that they wanted to get their story out as to what actually happened and the reality of what policing in Northern Ireland during those dark years was actually like. And it's done without comment, without anything. It's quite literally trying to put the reader in the front seat of a police car, and when that radio crackled into life, you didn't know whether in a few minutes you'd be dead, you'd be injured, you'd be helping someone, or you'd be laughing. It really was as bizarre and as extreme as that, and I was really just trying to let the reader see the reality of policing and the consequences of human beings' actions against other human beings.
You talk about maybe getting a laugh at the end of the day, or also your own life being at risk, arriving at a scene where there's been carnage. And one of the examples you use in the book was the investigation into the Shankill butchers. That's in this particular book. Those who were involved in that investigation must have been dealing with one of the horrors, the greatest horrors of the Troubles.
Absolutely, and some of the officers, particularly in the murder squad, as well as uniformed officers who were the first on the scene whenever bodies would be discovered, are still dealing with it and suffering from what they saw and the accumulation of the number of murders. I mean, the murder squad in Tennant Street at that time consisted of 10 people without a computer between them. And I mean, apart from the butchers' atrocities that were carried out, they also dealt with, over that same period, 155 other murders, those 10 men. So, I mean, sometimes they were just going from murder to murder to murder. And obviously that pressure builds up on anyone, and even uniformed people attending, bodies being found at such and such. And people, as in the public, obviously, who are protected from it don't perhaps realise just what exactly that means. But, I mean, I worked in Tennant Street myself, and when I first went up there, part of your detail, if you were on night duty, was to do a body patrol to go around the area to look at entries and skips or up, and there was a rural road where quite a few people were dumped, and it was to find the bodies before the public did.
Shocking. It is absolutely shocking. But the reality is that that's the way it was. We only have to look at a programme like Frontline on UTV, or indeed this recent Spotlight series on the BBC, to know that it was carnage. And I saw a pop program, Pop Goes Northern Ireland, the other night, where they put music to the Troubles, and it just was death after death after death. Now, I know there will be people listening to this program, understandably people listening to this program saying, oh, what are you talking to a cop about the cops for? I'm talking to a writer about the cops who used to be a cop. So this interview is not about analysing who was on for the RUC or who was against the RUC or who blighted the copybook of the RUC, blotted the copybook of the RUC, or who was included whenever the great gloom of collusion fell on police officers. We're talking about ordinary cops doing ordinary work every single day during the Troubles. That's what your book's about, isn't it?
That is what the book is. It's as I've described it sometimes, I was trying to humanise the uniform, because people see a uniform, but again, they don't look at the mother or the father behind that uniform, the brother or the sister, the person out there is. I mean, they're just a member of the public when they're not at work, the same as you or anyone else. And when they went, ordinary people just put into extraordinary circumstances. And that's why it's done without comment. There's no, people shouldn't do this. There's no side chosen. It's quite literally, if terrorists from whatever quarter did whatever it was they did and the police were responding to it, it just tells the story of what they did to deal with it, to investigate it, whatever it might have been. But no side is chosen or mentioned or singled out, because that's not what it's about. This is the human story of having to tidy up after what other people did.
And
as well as some of the lighter moments and, in ordinary policing.
Of course, and I want to get to those lighter moments in a second, but in this book you also take us to Enniskillen in 1987.
Yes, obviously that's a story that has, I suppose, followed Northern Ireland around the world, with it being Remembrance Day and what happened and the number of people killed and injured. And, a lot of these officers wanted their story to be told, but had great difficulty in doing it, and they suffer from what they witnessed, but felt it was important to get the story out on record. And, that one particularly, the one gentleman who was telling me, he wanted to tell me, and he just wanted to get it out almost in one breath, but couldn't do it because he still suffers from it to this day. Broke down numerous times while telling the story. And, my heart went out to him while he was doing it. And you have to give him every credit for wanting to get what it was actually like on record.
Do you feel that as time goes on, the post-traumatic stress element of this is shrouding police officers? Do they need significant help and guidance from psychiatrists?
Unquestionably they do, and there are organisations which do help them. The police have one near Hollywood, there's a Fermanagh, there's F Group, do fantastic work with people who are suffering, because very often they were left to suffer in silence, and it wasn't really the image, that if you thought you needed help. And back in the day, even in mine, there was no help. If you were shot at, if you were out on patrol or whatever it may have been, or been at some horrendous incident, as I always remark, it was, a bottle of whiskey with the inspector or something, and then you were left to make your own devices and come in the next day. But there was no counselling per se, and obviously a lot of things. If you take Tennis Street that we spoke of there, and there was body patrols, well, the worst month that Tennis Street had was 29 murders in 31 days. And, for any murder squad or any police officers or any human being, having to deal with that, go and attend the ensuing horrors of what that brings, and then just go home for your tea with your wife and children, or husband and children. It's quite an ask, but they did it, and some of them caught up with.
It does. It just sounds, when you put it like you're delivering it to us, Colin, as just merciless, absolutely merciless. When you watch the documentaries at the moment, and we see the police in action for better or for worse, and we see quite a bit of footage on television now of the police beating into protesters with batons, firing rubber bullets, and actually beating into protesters on the documentary with Spotlight on both sides of the community. They beat the living daylights out of civil rights campaigners, and then in the mid-80s they beat the living daylights out of protesters who were protesting against the Anglo-Irish agreement. How do you feel when you see that, the police on the screen all these years later doing that?
Well, I'm probably different with your description of beat the living daylights out of, but I understand what you mean, that force was used to sometimes clear the street and try and maintain public order. But you've also got to bear in mind, and when you go back to the civil rights, and I don't like singling out particular sides of the difficulty, but the police in that time, I mean, they didn't really know what they were doing either. I mean, I remember one policeman telling me when we were talking about that, he got sent up to Derry in an old Cumber van, and he went up and he came back 10 days later in the shirt he went up in, and slept on the streets. He said if it hadn't been for the Salvation Army, we wouldn't even have had food. So it was a learning curve for everyone, and there was no sophistication the way there may be now as to how to control public order. And everything sort of evolved from the start of it. The people, even when the civil rights movement started, and then when it got hijacked by a more violent crowd, I mean, all of that was sort of an embryonic police force trying to keep pace with fast-moving circumstances. And in the circumstances, they were doing the best they could, and the people who were, I suppose, in charge, to be fair, didn't really know what they were doing either. And that officer told me, he said, I went up there thinking somebody knows why I'm here and what I'm supposed to be doing. But when I got there, I realised they didn't know any more than I did.
Because it comes across on the screen. I'm listening to your description of it, but it does come across on the screen to anyone watching it today, and for people who would have been there at the time, that the police landed in en masse and just beat the crap out of any Catholic they could see.
Well, I certainly wouldn't say that it was done, and certainly never in my time. I mean, I can't speak for that era, but it certainly wouldn't have been done. The protesters, from whatever side they were, may have run into force from the police trying to keep the peace. But I mean, I don't think that it was a bit too straightforward to single them out religiously. Similarly, with the riots in the late 60s that were going on in Paris and going on in America and in Vietnam, demonstrations, when you look back at those, I mean, it looks very mob and very heavy-handed, but again, it's back to Grosvenor Square in London. It all comes down to how policing has evolved, and what it is now is obviously a very different kettle of fish for both protester and the forces of law and order. And the immediate one that across the world that'll get the bad name will always be the police, because they're coming to try and sustain order, or perhaps stop someone doing from what they want to do, should it be a march. And the police were acting under orders, don't forget, as well, from the old Stormont regime, and told what they had to do. So it wasn't like some police officers sitting somewhere and say, let's go down and do X, Y, and Z, for a bit of crack. It was just the way that they were put in those circumstances. And as I say, that guy up there for 10 days, he said nobody knew what they were doing, including us. And that's just the way it was. And we forget how long ago it was. I mean, the people investigating murders have told me that when they went to a murder in North Belfast particularly, it's always been a high rate. They'd barely time to get the name and address of the deceased before they were away to the next one. And then 40 years later, someone's going to ask you, well, why didn't you do X, Y, or Z? And it was really just, I mean, if you're talking about cuts and the lack of manpower now, I mean, it's day and night from what it was like back then, to be fair to them.
There's some interesting points that you make. It is always going to be a book for the police, by the police, about the police. I accept that from your perspective, Colin. Many people will read it and detest it because they still detest the police, or they've detested the police for the greater part of their lives. Others will read it and get a sense of just how difficult and how heartbreaking it was to be a police officer forever looking over your shoulder.
I would disagree, Frank, insofar as it's a police for the police, by the police. It's really showing what the police were doing, and they've never spoken before and were never ever really given a voice in what has been going on. Plenty has been written about them and for them, but this was actually giving them a voice, and as I say, it's done without opinion. But members of the public, in other words, non-police, are people who I find are coming to me, or feedback I'm getting in social media, or even reviews on Amazon and things, and they're saying to me, you know, I grew up in Northern Ireland and didn't know this was going on, because there's no comment in it. So it's not for the police. I think there's a lot of people, I mean, the troubles in inverted commas are supposed to be over now for some 20 years, so there's a whole generation who are feeding back to me, telling me that they're amazed what it was like, because nobody ever knew what it was like to actually be on the street trying to prevent what was going on. Everybody can point out where they may have stumbled or gone wrong, but nobody ever tells them how they could have necessarily done it better, because that's just not the nature of things. But I can assure you it's a book that anyone with an interest in Northern Ireland will enjoy, and indeed one reviewer who's from West Belfast actually wrote that he wouldn't have been the greatest fan of the police, and when he got the book he thought it was going to be a work the police great, which is not that sort of book. I mean, it's works and all, and he said it changed his opinion. He said whenever I got to the end of it, I just realised that these were people that earn a living just like the rest of us.
Well, Henry MacDonald from The Observer and The Guardian, he's the Ireland correspondent. He says Colin Breen has provided a most powerful and unique insight into the world's most dangerous job in policing in the 70s and 80s. And Henry MacDonald, of course, wouldn't be behind the wall when it would come to saying what he thinks. So at the end of the day, he is a respected voice on it. Colin, we didn't get a chance to talk about a happy moment in it, a jolly moment, a laugh. Do you have one briefly?
Well, one very brief one comes to mind. Was a lady phoned Mount Pottinger police station to complain about an army helicopter hovering over her head, and the policeman said, well, I'll try and find out what's going on for you. And she was complaining about the noise, and but there was obviously very little he could do. You know, who do you phone him? And this has gone on. So she phoned a few times, very pressed, I'm not doing the story justice, but she phoned a few times, and every time it was worse. This is terrible, I can't get to sleep, the kids are awake now, and the noise is just getting terrible, and what am I going to do? And eventually he told her that he was very sorry, but he was just off the phone with them, and it turned out the helicopter had broken down, and they were waiting on another one coming from the airport to tow it in. And she said, oh, right, oh, that's great. Well, thanks very much for finding that out for me. And the way she went, quite happy.
If I see a helicopter being towed, I'll know what's wrong with it.
you'll know what's happening. There's trouble somewhere.
Colin, thanks very much for coming on. Colin Breen's book, A Force Like No Other, The Next Shift. It's the follow-up to A Force Like No Other. It's available now if you want to read it and make up your own mind. This is the U105 phone-in. Good morning.